The Millennial Express, ploughing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. And now, for I think the first time this year, it's a triple screen layout, because I've got two guests, but they are together, the Culture Dads. That sounds like a gay couple. Sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I didn't mean it to sound like that. But nonetheless, it's Mike from Imperium Press and Dave Martell. Dave was a very popular guest last year. He had a very high energy stream. And of course, Mike from Imperium Press is a mainstay of the movement, and he has appeared for the last few years as well. So welcome back, Dave and Mike.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
All right, excellent. Why don't you introduce yourselves briefly? Mike, you go first.
Okay, well, I am Mike Maxwell, editor-in-chief of Imperium Press, which I think a lot of guys know, but we are a publisher of classics. The aim is to reissue the Western canon in ways that are, but just true to the canon itself, which it seems that mainstream academia has pretty much dropped the ball on in the last couple of generations. So we reissue a lot of classics, things like, you know, the Iliad, Shakespeare, and whatnot. But we also we publish contemporary authors as well. Some of the best theory that's going on in the right today. So yeah, in a nutshell, that is what Imperium Press is about. And I am the editor in chief of that and one half of Culture Dads.
All right. Excellent. And Dave, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah. For folks who don't know, I'm Big Dave Martell. I'm editor in chief of the Bizarre Cods, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic and Machines, which is a pulp publication. And we put out lots of great works of fiction from the literary traditions of fantasy, science fiction, and cosmic horror. We republish old stuff, and we also publish new stuff, such as here's some of our releases from this year. Hellflower from George O. Smith. That was came out in the 1940s. It's a sci-fi book. We got The Horror Beneath from C.P. Webster. He's one of our guys, a guy that has been published many times with the Bizarre Archives itself. We got House on the Borderland, which is a really, really classic, one of the first cosmic horrors from the 1920s from William Hope Hodgson. We got the Masters of Horror Collection, which is a collection of greats. And this one we got like Ambrose Bierce and Lovecraft and Arthur Machen and so many other greats. And then, of course, we also have the main Bizarre Kais series, which features up-and-coming authors from the based fiction scene, such as A. Cuthbertson, many, many other guys, lots of guys. A. Cuthbertson, Jim Bonner, M.S. Jones, just lots of great guys. Lots of great guys are in these books. As well as this one had a comic. We do comics and art and poetry and all kinds of stuff is in there. So the Bizarre Archives is what we do. And I'm also the other half of Culture Dads as well. Me and Mike have been doing this for, Mike, how many episodes? We're coming up on 80 episodes we've been doing this.
I think we just did number 75.
75. It's a good run. It's a good run.
Oh, that seems like a good entree into asking what is the Culture Dads and when did it start?
So the Culture Dads got started. So me and Mike, we've been friendly for quite a while, right? He reached out to me when I was doing The Bog, which was another podcast I was doing, which just came back, by the way. But Mike was tuning into The Bog, and he hit me up, and he told me about what he was about. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. And he wanted to come on my show and talk about his newest release, which I believe it was Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition, or maybe it was Beowulf. It was one of his Western canon series. So I went and I got a couple of his books, and I loved them, and me and him started chatting. And then, you know, we got really friendly. We've been back and forth on each other's podcasts and talking and, you know, brainstorming and all this kind of stuff. I get into publishing. I start doing the Bizarchives, and Mike was, he's like a mentor to me. He's like really, really helped me out, get started with this. And then one day, you know, the Bog was winding down. Ran out of steam, and we shut that down, and I wasn't really doing anything. And me and Mike were kind of talking back and forth about doing something together, a collaboration of some kind. And eventually we came up with this idea. It's like, Mike, you bring your big brain, I'll bring my big mouth, and we'll team up for a good podcast. And now it's 75 episodes later. And I got to say, you know, if we're not the best duo in the game, we're top five. I got to say that.
And it feels kind of like we're hitting our stride, too. I mean, 75 episodes in. I think the last one we did was like one of our best. The one we just recorded last night it's like, which one of your children do you love the most? it's hard to pick one. But yeah, you know, I definitely have some favorite episodes and everything. But talking about the origins of Culture Dads, it's kind of funny. I remember when Dave pitched the idea to me about doing a podcast about like modern culture, modern movies and music and stuff like that. And I said to him, I love this idea. I think it's amazing. I just don't know if I'm the guy. I don't know if I'm the one to talk about this stuff, because like I'm a musician, and I actually worked in the music industry in some degree for years. So I know about music, but I know nothing about movies. Like, I can't tell you the number of times that Dave will come to me and be like, yo, let's do this movie. And I go back to him. I'm like, you know, I've never seen RoboCop. He's like, what? What are you talking about? This happens to me all the time. Right?
So, I get it all the time as well. Not with RoboCop, because that's one of my favorite films, but with loads of films. So I know the kind of situation, Mike.
So very often it's a Mike Reacts podcast where Dave is sort of like curating and guiding me through these things or whatever. But, you know, occasionally it'll be the tables will turn, and I'll throw him something that like I'm totally into and he's never heard before. So it's cool. It's like there's a freshness and a kind of like aliveness to that, because you get to see one of us, or sometimes both of us, discover something for the first time. So it's pretty cool, actually.
And one of the best parts of it is the dads that tune in, the guys that are listening, all the time they message me, yo, man, this is the first time I checked this out. That was awesome. Thanks for doing that shit. And that's just really cool. That's really special that we can bring new enjoyment into people's lives with the art and entertainment and stuff like that. I love it.
All right. I was just sending you a message about this kind of thing. You can get it after the show. Is there a particular angle that you would, if you were to say, how does this show distinguish itself from other similar things? How would you describe it concisely?
So, kind of the pitch of the show is it's two, you know, publishing fathers that get together to do deep dives into pop culture for people that are like us. And that's so kind of the...
Does the fatherly aspect play into it, or is that just in the name?
No, that was a big deal for us, because one of the things that we always talk about is how much we hate how fathers are represented in modern culture. So if you go back, you watch some old TV shows. Like, Dad was a boss back in the old black and white TV shows. He came in, he stood straight, he wore a suit. You know, everybody respected him. He was loved, or he was the kids. If there was a show of kids, oh man, Dad's going to be home. So Dad was cool. Like, Dad was a boss back then. fast forward, you'd get Homer Simpson and Peter Griffin, these like fat retards. And I just don't like that depiction of the father. It's a complete deconstruction of the father. And traditionally in society throughout all of history, the father was cool. He wasn't just cool. He was the authority of the household and of society. For example, the way that we would define nations throughout most of history was through descent of a patriarch, a great king of the past, or a hero, or something like that. That is what defined our identities. So the fact that today, which you know, Mike's probably going to go into all of this, the totality of the modern liberal mindset effectively boils down to "fuck you, dad." It's a rebellion against the father, rebellion against the patriarch, and it's just a hideous, monstrous thing that has happened. And we were like, you know, we want to come back and make it cool to be a dad, because being a dad is cool. Being a dad is the coolest.
It's funny how that it's so telling that the figure of the father is ridiculed in media nowadays, because leftist politics, it's been widely said that leftist politics is basically a rebellion against male authority. And often stems from personal issues that the individual leftist has with his or her father. Mm. I think it's definitely true. I mean, you can see it. It's tangible.
So yeah, absolutely.
It's like a direct line from the psychological motivations to what they do in the media. They make dad look like a prick, make him look hypocritical, weak, clueless, insecure, aggressive, all the rest of it. And of course, nowadays also white privilege and all of that kind of thing.
Of course.
Yeah, and there's a connection there between anti-patriarchy, anti-fatherhood, and anti-nationalism, of course, because the word patriarch or father and patriotism have a common root. It's rooted in the common idea of what Dave just said, basically, that what a nation is fundamentally, you know, people will constantly ask, you know, what is white? You know, what is American? What is this and that? What it is fundamentally is it's pointing back to a founder and saying, that guy, this is our guy. This is the one who founded what we're all about. This is our genetic ancestor. This is our spiritual ancestor, and so on and so forth. So all that stuff undercuts all the spurgery of, you know, what is white, sort of logic chopping and everything. But the hatred of fatherhood, the hatred of men sort of more broadly, is also it's a dig against nationalism itself. Because, of course, what is the word nation? What is the root of the word nation? Well, it's natio, which is related to natal. It's essentially like, you know, ethno-nationalism is basically nationalism. So, and it's all tied up with the same sort of attack upon all of these things together. And, you know, I got to say, it doesn't just come from the left. It also, sadly, in some cases, comes from the right. Like, we just posted a video. Actually, I think it was the second video that we posted on YouTube. If anybody goes on YouTube, go on there, look up Culture Dads with a K and subscribe to the YouTube channel, because we've got some pretty cool videos that are popping off now. The second one that we put out was a really, really great rant that Dave did in one of our earlier videos about the authority of the father, basically reiterating some of the stuff that was just said. And you would not believe the brigade that we got, the manosphere descending on us to say, look, you know, the father is something that, you know, it's not what we shouldn't become fathers. We should just basically become these, you know, men trying to glut themselves with sense gratification and go and bang a whole bunch of women, and fatherhood is de-radicalizing and all this absolute nonsense. But you would not believe how much these people were triggered by the idea, the simple idea that the father needs to return to authority if things are to be put to rights. There are people
I can say some pretty negative things about that, about the MRA. And, you know, yeah. I think a lot of these guys have had a fucking bad time with the divorce courts, with women, thoughtery and manipulation. It's often guys, I think, who 100 years ago they'd have been absolutely fine. You know, they're trusting, and they've been taken advantage of, and so they react by becoming very bitter, and then they discover MGTOW, MRE, and then they make a lifestyle out of it. I mean, it's tragic, it's sad, but as for the practical usefulness of it, you know, feminism works for women in a sense. It'll leave them childless and bitter in the end, but at least it seems to give their life purpose. It seems to work in a sense. But I don't believe that because they'll often say this is feminism for men, it's meninism or whatever. But I don't believe it does the same for them. I think it leaves them just fucked. I don't say that with any glee at all. And, you know, if you're a guy and you find that this has worked for you, fine. I actually think that there are some guys for whom it probably is the best option because they're so unable to deal with the world as it is today. It's the ruthless dating scene and all that yeah. Perhaps MGTOW is the best thing for them. They're too vulnerable to being exploited by women and whatever. And, you know, it can happen to anyone. But I think for some it is the best, but for most guys, it's not a good idea. It will just leave you bitter and jerking off.
And it's not just that. There's quite a few figures out there that kind of paint this, you know, the Sigma male meme, and you know, various figures that just have this same kind of functionally identical message to men. That, you know, I had guys. I think it was might have been in the K-Dad's comments. Some like little, you know, you guys are just telling everybody to become male moms and all this kind of, well, we should go become heroes and all this kind of, or something like that. Here's the deal is that there's only like one hero. There's only one guy that can rise to that. And a lot of these dudes, these you know, internet celebrities that get everybody all high on these, you know, these fantasies of becoming heroes, they're robbing guys of the most simple purpose that they could have. Most people, most men, more than most, almost all men are not going to become heroes, are not of great exceptional ability that they can go do something that is beyond being a father or whatever. For almost all men, the greatest thing that they can do, the most fulfilling role and purpose that they can have in life is to sire children and to be a dad. And that's not a lowly thing. That's a beautiful, wonderful thing. And in fact, when society has these hierarchies, these patrilineal hierarchies that start from the bottom and work all the way to the top, is when society becomes healthy. Until we return the father to his role as the leader of the household, the power of the father, until the power of the father comes back in society, nothing will change. Nothing will get better. You know, the father needs to be in the house to oversee who his children marry. He needs to oversee what goes on in his greater household. He needs to be able to award his sons different occupations or whatever. There needs to be a transgenerational exchange of wealth. Wealth needs to come down through all of the above. All of the above that happen in traditional actual patriarchy needs to come back. And then we could talk about abstracts and stuff all day long, but it starts at home.
Yeah. And one other thing, that an aspect of the patriarchy that men need to do is they need to become the regulators of culture again, because so much of it is just poisonous. And women actually have a role here, I think, but it would really be better if the men were doing it, because, you know, when, for example, if you think about a nice town or village or something, it's all very wholesome. And then someone comes along and opens a porn shop. Yeah. The men of the town should not think, oh, that'll be good for my teenage son. They should think that's going to be bad for everyone. And they should go and make sure that shop shuts down. That's what the patriarchy should do. As long as we have this passive culture where men just think, oh, well, whatever, The government will take care of it if it's bad. I don't need to. My misgivings that I instinctively feel, I should just bury them because it's obviously not, it's not my place. And well, no, it is your place. It absolutely is your place to influence the culture in your society, especially in your local community. What the fuck else are men for if not for that?
Yeah. We shit on libertarians a lot in our sphere, and it's a lot of it's deserved. But you know what? At the end of the day, they do have some very healthy instincts. And one of the things that they don't like that I think is very good not to like is the idea of the nanny state that enervates men and turns them into a grown children. The whole kidult phenomenon, you know, men that are stunted and like. There's nothing wrong with like looking back on your childhood fondly of having nostalgia and everything like that, but there is a kind of arrested development in men that's been fostered by this kind of idea that the government will take care of all your problems, that all the intermediaries in society, like the churches, like the unions, like, you know, prominent families and nobility, all that stuff has basically been erased or done away with or made obsolete by the idea of an overbearing state. I very much understand that sentiment and agree with that. But you know what? The fact is that if there's nothing to be put in its place, then that state is necessary. And really what needs to be put in its place is strong men, strong families, clans, tribes, this sort of thing. This is how law and order gets enforced in society, is basically by localism and that sort of thing. And for, you know, not to hack on these people all day, but like the pickup artist crowd and everything like that, to look at the state of sexual dynamics and say that this is a bad thing, it needs to go back to the way it was, and then offer this absolute snake oil that might work for a handful of men like the Andrew Tates of the world or whatever. If you've got a six pack, you're good to go and everything. But the vast majority of men, it's going to be a complete disaster for them. Well, this is just kind of enshrining the individualism that really led us into that problem in the first place. And the ultimate result of that is that it reinforces and renders eternal the very problem in the first place that they're trying to solve. So you might solve the problem for one guy or a couple of people, but the fact is that that if we're being honest, every society that ever built anything worth having, every society that built a structure more than one story tall, was built on the backs of an ocean of beta male energy. It was built on the normal person having his rulers have his best interests in heart. The idea of noblesse oblige, the man in the street having an elite that feels connected to him, that believes that it is of the same piece, of a piece with him, and that it has his interests at heart. It's every society that anybody cares about that we read about in the history books had this idea of noblesse oblige, that the leader leads both for his own sake, but also for the sake of the men under him. He gets into the trenches with him. And this is exactly what the Manosphere doesn't do.
Yeah. And I would also like to point out one of the most terrible things that the Manosphere has done is to create this bad connotation around the idea of, you know, the beta male, right? The beta male. So everybody wants to be an alpha. Like I said before, there's only one hero. There's only one alpha. Most guys are beta males, and that's not a bad thing. The beta male is the number two. Think about, you know, let's talk about movies. How many movies or shows where there's a guy who's a number two and is he a bitch? Is he a scumbag? Is he pathetic or whatever? We just did a thing on Sopranos. Who's the number two in Sopranos? Silvio Dante. You know, who's going to mess with Silvio Dante? Everybody respects Silvio Dante. He's the administrator. He's the guy that facilitates. He's the guy that handles things, right? You look at the Godfather. Tom Hagen, the son, right? Number two. Or Michael or Sonny, one of the number twos that's involved, the consigliere. Right. Is a counselor to the chief. Is he a beta? Is he a bitch? No, he's not. He's a immensely important role in the hierarchy of their thing. And we don't have that anymore because nobody wants to do that. Everybody wants to LARP as the alpha, LARP as the boss, LARP as this. And then there's no hierarchy and there's no tribe and there's no togetherness. There's no Mannerbund. It's just every guy, you know, avoiding that. And that's, I think this plays into, we today have so many layers of self-hate on so many things. On who we are as a people, on who we are as men, on who we are as people today, like modernists, right? As we're, our whole thing in this thing is reject modernity. But let's face it, we are modern people. We are modern people. We like modern things. We were born, we can't help it, thrownness and all that, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, that's another angle of culture dads, is we hold up these things that have been created in the last few decades and say, these things are legitimately great. These things are legitimately timeless. Some of the creators that have made art and entertainment in our times, in our lifetimes, are some of the greatest of all time that could stand with the greats. One of my favorite painters, Frank Frazetta, he was around in the 70s. You know, when did he die? In the 90s or whatever. You know, that guy could walk around in Florence and they would think that he's one of their equals. That's how damn good he was. Fantastic artist, right? There's how many like films do we have today that we could take Homer, we could take Shakespeare, take any of the names of the greatest guys that ever lived and sit them down and show it to them and they would think that it's fucking dope, right? How many albums of bands today, like rock and roll bands, that are just masterpieces that we could show to Tchaikovsky or Mozart or whatever and they would think that it's beautiful. Right? You know, I could think of so many albums off the top of my head. Rush 2112, Deep Purple, Machine Head, you know, Keeper of the Seven Keys from Helloween. All of these albums that we love today that are fantastic, that are musical masterpieces. Those guys that I just mentioned, if you sat them down and showed it to them, I'm sure that they would be proud of us. They would be proud of our era. So what I argue and what the Culture Dads is about is taking these things that are just came out yesterday. And by yesterday, I mean, you know, within the last few decades or maybe just within our time period, our father's generation or whatever, and looking at them and doing a deep analysis. Because a lot of these things, one of the layers of self-hate that we have is about being modern. We hate everything. Oh, well, that just came out. It's, you know, and that's a healthy instinct. That's a folkish worldview. That is the Weltanschauung of the ancestral tradition, is to think that that which came before was superior than we are today. That is a healthy thing to think. However, it doesn't mean that we suck. It doesn't mean that our chapter in the ancestral saga needs to be forgotten. Because if we forget it and we don't do anything, we don't continue to create, it's like not having any kids. We die. We have to continue that tradition. We have to continue these things. And we have to look at, so what we do is we lift these things up and we do an analysis on them. And what we find under the hood many times is that in the DNA of this stuff, even stuff like RoboCop, The Sopranos, The Godfather, certain like comic books, video games, music movements, you know, subgenres, all of this kind of stuff that we dig into, we find the DNA and the lineage that goes back into the mists of history. And because of that, it gives it legitimacy. So what we do is we say, no, these aren't just, you know, modern crap. You know, whether we're talking about, I don't know, some of the music movements that we've talked about, whether we're talking about, I don't know, certain heavy metal movements or grunge or punk rock or you know, the invention of the electric guitar. That was like one of my favorite episodes. We talk about culinary traditions. One of my favorite episodes that we did was on pizza. You wouldn't believe how awesome pizza is. It's a great episode. Because we lift up the hood of these things that we take for granted today. And we show that this isn't just some crap that popped up. This isn't just some corporate garbage. These things have legitimate roots in folk tradition. And show people that you don't have to hate yourself for that. We do have vitality today. And we do still create beautiful things.
Yeah, and I'll give you the TLDR of the pizza episode. Although
I was going to ask. That was going to be my next question. Can you get as a good example of what you're talking about, could you explain about pizza? Because I do actually, I know I'm a fan of pizza myself.
Yeah, of course. I mean, who's not, right? I spent like 10 years cultivating and, you know, putting together my pizza dough recipe. And actually, in that episode, in the show notes, I give guys my recipe. But here's the thing, though, is something like that seems kind of like, okay, well, what does that have to do with like where we're at today in terms of the deep state and nationalism and all the, and the horrible things in modernity? Well, the fact is that every people undergoes to be a people it's required to undergo an ethnogenesis. And there are a number of things that play into an ethnogenesis, the making of a people. One of those things is, of course, culinary traditions. Culinary traditions may sound like something that's kind of trivial, or like it's not as high and deep as something like, you know, epic poetry or the founding of a nation or whatever, but it plays into it. It's very important. The fact is that one of the most intense sensory inputs that you have that makes you nostalgic for the past is your sense of smell and taste. When you smell certain things, it just takes you right back to a certain place. When you taste certain things, when you taste grandma's, you know, gingerbread recipe, it's like it just takes you right back to your childhood. And all of those feelings, all of those pre-rational things that are just in there and at the pith and marrow of your being that goes to make up who you are. The fact is that pizza is for Italian people much more than a source of carbs. It's got a lot more going for it than that. It's part of their history. It's part of who they are. It's part of how they identify. And what this is ultimately leading towards is, I think, the fundamental problem. If you could boil down modernity, the problem of modernity, to one thing, and of course you can't, but if you wanted to try, probably the best candidate would be what we call oikophobia, which is a, you know, $5 term to say a hatred of home. It's a hatred of the familiar. It's a hatred of what's close to you, right? If you think about it, if you unpack this idea of hating what's close, it really does underlie every objection that the left has to the right, every objection that the liberal has to, globalism has to nationalism and everything like that. This is kind of what's at the bottom of all the things that are wrong today, is a hatred of what's close and familiar. And something that seems kind of trivial, like pizza, is one of those things that is just utterly pre-rational. And by pre-rational, I don't mean stupid or irrational. I mean that which is generative of rationality. It's what comes first. It's what it has a transcendental relationship to rationality. This is the axiom or the assumption that you begin with in order to undertake reason. This is the kind of thing that is at the bottom of something like culinary traditions and traditions in general. So if one of the things that the right, and especially the nationalist right, really leans into in certain terms or another, however you want to phrase it, is the idea of thrownness. The idea that you are thrown into a time and place, you are born to a particular family, you learned a certain language, and that all these things color your being in ways that you just can never get out from under. You can never, you know, Stephen Colbert may be able to teach himself to not have the South Carolina accent that he was born with. He may be able to disabuse himself of that, but he will never get rid of where he was born. He'll never get rid of his family history. He'll never get rid of his racial history, anything like that. That is something that he can never escape. That's his thrownness. And we are thrown into our particular nations. But you know where else? What else we're thrown into? We're thrown into today. We're thrown into modernity. And although there is something to the idea of reject modernity, return to tradition, the fact is that if you reject modernity completely, you're just leaning into oikophobia. You're leaning into the very problem that is at the bottom of everything that leads you to want to reject modernity. So if we're going to be consistent nationalists, if we're going to be consistent, you know, illiberals or whatever it is, then we need to accept where we are today, and we need to move forward. We need to lean into that, and we need to love what's close to us, which means we need to love the music and movies and culture that we have today. And that's a big part of what Culture Dads is all about.
Yeah, speaking of thrownness, I'm trying to throw that pizza in my mouth. Mm. You're killing me here, Wes.
I thought it would be good to have an illustration. I do have a folder of, well, food images, and then autistically within that, it's divided down. So I chose a pizza image for you.
Nice.
So I guess I would ask, you're saying that we should be, in some sense, comfortable with this age that we've been born into. I guess you could, you tell me, is the fitting analogy to be okay with being born into a mediocre town or a crap city or something, even though you know it's crap. What would you say about that, Mike?
Well, I would say that if the requirement to love something is that it be the best, that this pretty much is what I would call propositionality, the idea that your identity is something that you can choose or that is not handed to you. I don't see any nationalism as being possible on the basis of we accept this thing because it answers to some abstract definition of good. It kind of puts the cart before the horse, right? Because if you want to say, okay, well, here is the standard of what's good or great or beautiful or whatever, I mean, where does that come from? Where do you actually get that standard? Well, at the end of the day, you get it from your tradition. It's the tradition that tells you, okay, here is the standard of beauty. This is what it is to be a good man. This is what it is to be a hero. All of that stuff actually comes from your culture. It comes from your locality. You know, there's, say, for example, something like a Papua New Guinean or something. You know, no disrespect to any people or whatever. It's just not what I would consider a high culture. It's not what I would consider like great and noble and amazing or whatever. But you know what? I also would never begrudge the Papuan to be proud of who he is. He should be proud of who he is. And anybody who disagrees and says, you know, he shouldn't be proud or he should LARP as a, you know, Western, you know, what is it, the weird and like Western educated, industrialized, and so on and so forth. Anybody that says that he should try to be that does not understand nationalism in the first place. So, yeah. You know, there's nothing wrong with being born into a people that is not, you know, the imperial center. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that if we put it upon ourselves that we can only be proud of ourselves if we are the imperial center, well, that's not really nationalism. It kind of actually grates against the idea of nationalism in the first place.
This is something that I often find repulsive when leftists will take an unfortunate photo, an unflattering photo of some nationalists and say, the Übermensch, you know, the master race, there it is. He's got a beer belly as if, so that man cannot believe in something higher or a hierarchy unless he embodies it himself. And unless he was born into it, then he's LARPing, he's lying. Well, I mean, it is there's truth there. He is LARPing in a sense, but believing in the thing is not the same as claiming that you are the thing. That, you know, believing in the best, let's just say it that way, does not mean that you think you are the best. So there are these two things about nationalism, which is, yes, a belief in hierarchy, yes, a belief in better and worse, but also a belief in the local and the organic and the natural and the given, the bequeathed, the inherited, which you don't choose, and you could never choose, and it would be an artificial, it would be a lie if you did choose some other identity. That's the whole point, really.
Yeah.
What
has more value, like treating yourself or receiving a gift? You know what I mean? How many, you know, it's Christmas time, right? A lot of people are going to be getting gift cards and stuff like that. What has more value? you taking yourself out, buying yourself a gift for Christmas or for your birthday or whatever, or somebody giving you something. So the thing that is given that you don't have choice with has more value, period. That's just the way that it is, right? And I had another thing I was going to say, but I forget what it was.
Yeah, and I would just sort of add to all that that it is impossible. I mean, okay, it's yes, we believe in the idea of right and wrong, objective reality. This is an important thing on the right and everything, but also the idea that, you know, different strokes for different folks, and the idea that having local traditions is great. I mean, it may seem like a kind of academic distinction to make, but I mean, I think it's important to see that subjectivism is really just the subjectivity of the individual. There's a difference between I as an individual am the highest authority and believe that, you know, I decide what's great as an individual, and what is great is particular to my culture. There's a massive, massive difference there. The one is absolutely consistent. It's absolutely fine for a Greek to have a different conception of the good than an Englishman or a Russian or whatever, but it's actually totally incoherent for the individual to say that he is the highest authority and he gets to decide what is, you know, objectively valuable or whatever, because how is he going to decide that? On what basis is he going to conclude it? Well, he's going to conclude it on the basis of assumptions. And where do those assumptions come from? They ultimately come from his culture. They ultimately come from his thrownness. So he can never escape that. It's even in principle, he can never escape the tradition. He can only just be an inconsistent traditionalist. And I think it's that if we recognize this particularity, or basically what is better put as folkishness, if we recognize this folkishness, this particularism of culture, then this just makes us better nationalists, basically, because it sort of sets us on a more solid foundation.
Also, that's what I was going to say, justifies itself. You know what I mean? So what you're talking about was with, they're like, oh, look at this, you know, fat retard, that's the Ubermensch and all that. They're presupposing that we presuppose utilitarianism. And you know what? We do a lot. A lot of people, like, for example, when we talk about culinary traditions, you know, for example, with pizza, when we did the pizza episode, we got a lot of reactions that were, oh, well, that's carbs. That's not good for you. And you shouldn't eat pizza. Pizza's for, you know, whatever, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is if you go to Naples and you tell those people that pizza sucks, you're going to get punched in your mouth. They're really serious about it because they innately know that that's part of their identity. Your identity isn't some abstraction, some political theory, or some anything out there. Your identity is who you are. Is what you eat. It's how you sing. It's how you dance. It's the art and culture that you like. It's how you cook. It's everything. All of those things that are closest to you, that are most familiar, that is what you are. And those things don't need to be justified. They don't need to have a utility. They are the purpose. They justify themselves. And
how could they even be justified? You know, they're justified on the basis of the assumptions that come from your culture. So it's impossible.
Exactly. Pizza is dope because it is.
I think that nowadays with a highly globalized world, we have there's a certain idea around that there are just objective standards. Like and Dave will, I think, understand exactly what I'm saying here. Something that's low budget, well, it's low budget. Therefore, it's not as good as something that's high, big budget, you know?
I love low budget. Some of my favorite movies are B movies. Oh man, this is a can of worms with me and Mike. We love this kind of stuff. But the deal with it is aesthetics does not need to be utilitarian at all. And makes it uglier.
Yeah, but the point I was going to make was that it's not a competition. That's the point.
No.
You don't say, well, this means a lot to me because I have looked at all the alternatives and judged it to be the best among all the alternatives. No, this means a lot to you because this means a lot to you. And probably because it's been important at a formative stage in your life, among other reasons. But that's one of the reasons. It's what you were born into. Therefore, it's meaningful, regardless off its so-called rivals in other cultures or other places. So it's not a competition between them. That's the point.
And also, a lot of what we like and it appeals to us is completely pre-rational, right? Like me and Mike do these analysis of these, you know, art forms and these art movements and films and stuff that we like, but that's not why we liked it. You, for example, when you hear a song that you fall in love with, do you fall in love with it because it has this meaning and these themes and this and that and because of the song structure or whatever? Or do you just fall, is it just completely pre-rational? Is it because you start nodding your head and you just fall in love with it? And then post hoc, you start cooking up all these reasons why. It's the former. You fall in love with it because you fall in love with it. And that's the meaning right there. That's the secret sauce right there, is that pre-rational love, that pre-rational association with it. And the reason that a lot of us, I don't know if folks notice, a lot of us here in these spheres are kind of the same guy, right? Like how many of us all like at least similar things? You know, I couldn't believe, for example, when I launched Bizarrechives, I was a little bit hesitant. I was like, you know, I don't know how many people around here are going to like. Turns out tons of people love this kind of stuff. You know, tons of guys in our sphere love Warhammer 40K and H.P. Lovecraft and the same kind of music that I like and the same this and the same that. We, you know, we all like similar stuff and adjacent stuff, probably because, I don't know, maybe it's a spiritual, metaphysical thing. We're biologically wired, we're predisposed or whatever. We came into these spheres because we're built to be here. We logicked our way here. We think that we rationalized our way here. And maybe there was some of that journey. But we were supposed to be here because we were built to be here. And that's a good thing. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And it's, I think, one of the things about this idea of pre-rationalism that is so important is that it's one of, like, the acceptance of the pre-rational as the sort of fundamental motivating force of people. And indeed, of the one of the ground of epistemology and morality itself is one of the things that actually separates the dissident right from the mainstream right, or the illiberal right from mainstream conservatism and whatnot, is just this idea, the acceptance of the pre-rational substratum, this heaving ocean of subconscious drives and motivations that is a good thing. This is something that the left really pushes back against as, of course, irrational and stupid and barbaric and primitive and backwards and everything. But it really actually is them that has it backwards. This is the sort of kernel of what motivates us as peoples. You know, there's something to the leftist critique of, you know, certain mid-century ideologies that they are irrational. There's something to that, except that's a good thing, not the irrationality per se, but the sort of the roiling energy that comes out of that, that is really the sort of animalistic or the instinctual substratum of everything that we love and believe. That is what comes first. And Woz, you were talking to Greg Johnson just before we got on here. I did an interview with Greg earlier this year about a book that we put out by George Sorel, and we got to talking about a different thinker by the name of Giambattista Vico, whom we discussed, Dave and I, on one of our episodes on postmodernism. Vico is this guy who is kind of like a pre-modern and postmodern right-winger. He's kind of like what Greg and I, the conclusion we came to is that Vico is kind of like our Marx. He is like the most fundamental theoretician of the illiberal or the radical right. And what he basically says is that what he calls the poetic is at the bottom of the rational, that first you get a Homer, then you get a Plato, and it doesn't go the other way around. So it's these pre-rational aspects. This is what motivates us to love things. This is what motivates us to have the love of home, the love of country, the love of nationalism. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. And not only is there nothing wrong with that, it could not be the other way around. There is no way for it to be any other way. So aesthetics is not something that's remotely trivial. Aesthetics as something that is very pre-rational. Like, you don't love the taste of a strawberry because you undertake some syllogistic ratiocinative deduction. You just love it because you love it, right? You love it because you're built to love it. There's a pre-rational love of that sort of thing. Or you love great art because you're just built that way. These are not trivial things at all. And aesthetics is super, super important. And, you know, I love, having gotten into the scene and like, it, I love it. It's like my, you know, these are my guys. This is my extended family, you know. But also at the same time, I got to say, there's a bit too much politics and not nearly enough like cool, beautiful stuff going on. You know, we could have, and we do have wonderful artistic talent in this sphere, but we could have a lot more of it. And I think that pound for pound, we punch way above our weight in that category vis-a-vis the mainstream. Like, the look at the absolute sterility of the mainstream in terms of, you know, remakes of remakes of remakes of movies, and they're exhausted, completely culturally exhausted. Whereas we have vitality. And I think one of the things about Culture Dads, we talk about aesthetics because aesthetics matter. They're important. They're not just the sort of cherry on top of the cake. They are the cake. It's right at the bottom of everything that we love.
Yeah, exactly. And with aesthetics and everything, one thing that I do criticize a lot is this idea that aesthetics should just be this vessel or this tool that we use to further ideas. Aesthetics are prior to ideas. That aesthetics, Mike, what did you say that one time? You said, we don't have aesthetics, aesthetics has us.
Right? Yeah.
I've gotten to the point, this is where I'm at in things. I have gone through the whole rigmarole, I've gone through my journey and everything, and now I just want to grill. That's it. I want to sell cool books. I want to make art. I want to, you know, raise my kids. I want to just be, because I've realized that just being and being a generative force in the world, creating art and creating culture and these kinds of things are really what makes us really believe in something, right? It gives our existence meaning, is to have culture. I used to do more political content, and I'm not knocking anybody that does political content and everything like that, but we don't need like a whole bunch of armchair geopolitical analysis. Like, let's be honest, a lot of you know, what we say doesn't really matter. Like, who's listening? Like, how many? We don't need that many people doing analysis on Israel and Ukraine or whatever the hell. Those people don't know who we are. Nothing that we say sways that situation. Who cares, right? You know, maybe some people. I'm not, like I said, that's just the way that I feel about it. But we do have a lot of guys that are wonderful singers, that are wonderful guitar players, that are great writers and poets and artists and filmmakers and stuff like that. We really have the potential to become a core of culture creation that exports a whole lot of beautiful things into the world, and nobody else can do it like us. You look at the conservatives, dude. Look at the crap that they make. They can't. Daily Wire. Look at Daily Wire. Millions and millions of dollars. Those guys couldn't make a good movie if you held a gun to their head. They suck. Their jokes are garbage. They're not funny. They're not good. They have no vision. They're not creative. They don't have it. They don't got the stuff. We got the stuff. And I think that, you know, it's going this direction too. I'm very, very proud to look around and, you know, with what I'm doing with the pulp stuff, doing pulp and fiction and all that. There's a lot of guys that are doing that now. I saw Raw Egg Nationalist, our buddy Raw Egg Nationalist, started a thing with Pulp Fiction. People are really getting interested in it. And I'm very proud that, you know, I was one of the original, you know, shout out my boy Brendan Hurd, or Arius Press with Aegion. You know, he was one of the guys that hopped on too. And it's not just Pulp Fiction. There's like little music scenes cropping up and all that. This is what we need. We need a space that we can live in, right? We live here now. This is who we are. And it's very possible that, you know, we can't change the way things are, that things are just going to keep going the way they're going, and it just needs to fall over. And if that's the case, you know, and we're going to be here for a while, why not make it beautiful and fun and cool and weird and interesting, right? Because we certainly have the talent to create that.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Dave and I say all the time on Culture Dads is that we need to sort of carve out this little space for ourselves. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at the history and you really read it with some breadth, you will find that, yes, of course, people have died for, they have given their lives for ideas and ideals and everything like that. But far more than that. And I mean, like, it dwarfs it. People die for their families. People die for their traditions. People are willing to give their lives for the things that have been handed to them and that have nothing to do with, you know, like, you can't say like that pizza is true or false. You can't say that this painting is true or false. You can't say that this tradition is true or false. A belief can be true or false, but the thing that undergirds the belief is pre-propositional. If your identity is something that you can be argued out of, it's a weak identity fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And this is just more propositionality. We need to carve out a space where we can enshrine those things that are pre-propositional, that are worth dying for. And again, this is something that we say all the time in Culture Dads, is that we need to carve out a little space for ourselves that we can inhabit, that we can live in. It's nationalist politics and politics in general is exhausting. The normal person finds it absolutely, like, they can only take so much of it. This is why, like, you know, guys like us who like politics, when we go to dinner with our families, they're just like, I don't want to hear anything about that. I don't want to talk about politics. It's because for normal people, it is exhausting. But you know what they love? They love their culinary traditions. They love their favorite music.
Well, it's the same for us ourselves, though. I mean, I don't want to talk about politics all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Even exactly. I don't want to, you know. So, sorry, Mike, shouldn't have interrupted.
No. You're absolutely right. I mean, we all feel that way too. Even those of us who are politically switched on, it's still exhausting. But we need to carve out a little space that is kind of like our refuge that we can take, you know, that we can live in, that we can gather strength from and go back and fight another day. And a huge part of that is creating culture, and it's creating modern culture, and not just sort of looking at the past and saying, oh, the past is gone, and we lament that, and we were so great, and now we're so fallen. The fact is that, you know, we look at ourselves today and we think we are the children of winter. And we are the children of winter, the Spenglerian winter. But I think a better way to think of ourselves is as the fathers of the springtime. We are going to, we are building the infrastructure. We are building the foundations of what comes next. And what comes next will be a 1,000-year reign of what is great and high and noble that emerges out of the ruins. And it's us who is going to build those foundations right now. This is what Dave and I are trying to do with our publishing companies. This is what guys in the scene are trying to do with, you know, pushing back against liberalism and everything like that. We need to think of ourselves as standing at the beginning of something rather than at the end of something, because as we all know, these things do, there is an ebb and flow to history, and we are at the end of a sort of cycle that's ebbing away, and what comes next is really up to us. And it's the people who show up that actually look forward into the future and say, we are going to be there. We're going to put our stamp on it, that it's people like that that actually change the course of history.
And also creating culture is more fun, and you can make a little bit of money doing it. Can't beat that. You can't beat it.
Yeah.
And there's one other thing that I would put in here, just to back up what you're both saying. I know a guy, and he's a really good guy. He's sort of nationalist, but he's also very rational, very into rational analysis, and which, you know, it's not a bad thing, but he takes it too far. And he often, like, when I will try to tell him about some TV drama that I've discovered from way back when, or a lovely painting that I've seen or something. And I'll show you some things that, just an example, things that really mean a lot to me, the things that move me. Things like this book cover, that I discovered about a year ago. And it's London in the early 70s. It's a children's book. I think that's just wonderful. And then another one, this is a book that I had as a child in the 90s. Just fantastic, lovely. And then this one, Of the Autumn. This is stuff that goes back to my childhood and beyond. And this is the kind of thing that really moves me. But if I showed it to this friend of mine, he would just say, well, it's meaningless. It doesn't matter. It's not intellectually, that there's no meaning to it in that sense. It's not justified. It's ultimately just toys. It's ultimately just trivia. And I think this is something, an objection that a lot of people would make to the kinds of things you're saying. But the thing is, that guy has also said that ultimately the British people aren't really worth saving because they've fallen, because they're degenerate, because they're no longer meeting his rational standard. And my point here is that he's detached. You know, because he's so rational, he's detached from beauty. And with that, he's detached from his own people. I think that's unhealthy. I don't think that's a good way to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, going back to the idea of saving the British people despite having fallen on hard times, you know, if you think of, I mean, as nationalists, there really is no alternative but to think of our nations as extended families. I think that's kind of doesn't need to be argued for. If you think about your own family, if your son falls on hard times, or if he gets himself involved in drugs, or your own father, say, that would be a better analogy because we're talking about the culture itself. If somebody in your family was to become a degenerate, would you just cast them away? Well, I think that the answer to that question is the same answer to, are you really actually a nationalist? Or it's the inverse, right? If you would cast them away, you're not a nationalist. You have completely misunderstood what ethno-nationalism is about. And you need to go back to the drawing board. Now, this is not to say that your friend, who I don't know who he is without value. I think that guy has value. The person who begins from rational premises, who believes that all things can be grounded in reason, that guy has value. He has an instrumental value. He's the guy who should be the consigliere. He's the guy who should be second in command. He's the advisor. But that attitude, being in charge, is another one of the main problems that we have today, is the idea of technocracy. The idea that experts should be in charge, that people who have a particular specialized skill set should be in charge. That has been a disaster for us. Has it not? This is what we have. This is, you know, just look at the fruits of technocracy today. It's the WEF. It's all of these disgusting transnational organizations that are killing us and erasing everything that's good and high and beautiful in the world. That is the fruit of technocracy. And what is technocracy fundamentally? It's the idea that the nerd or the science guy should be in charge rather than the legitimate king. Because, you know, fundamentally, the expert that is the most important, that you need more than any other expert, is the expert leader. And the paradigm of the expert leader is the father. So it's coming back to around to, it's the absence of patriarchy. Basically, this is kind of what's at the bottom of what's ailing us today. And this, and when you get rid of that, all of these things get out of joint in such a way that it's very, very hard to find your way back to it until you set that to rights, until you put the legitimate king in the seat of power, right? And in the home, that's the father. In the clan, that's the chieftain, all the way up to the king himself. So, you know, the alternative to that basically is technocracy. And that's what we have today. So,
yeah, and it's an attitude that they encourage with talking about things like merit-based immigration, you know, so that these people are good enough to, they make the grades so they can join our economic zone. You know, I think that's hideous because, and also it means that British people who don't make the grade, well, what should they be thrown in the river? I mean, you know, I once said a long time ago, I would love the British people, even if they became communist, you know, even if they fell to that, I would still love them because they are the British people and they are my people, my kind. And, you know, it's not a, it's a statement that I've had doubts about it here and there along the way because of the way they are, because of the way they behave, because they hate me for who I am, you know, this kind of thing. It's difficult to maintain a loyalty. But I think the things that the two of you have said in this stream have sort of encouraged me to think, yeah, I was right to say that. And it is the right attitude to have.
Yeah. Well, here's a
regardless of their beliefs, they don't need to pass a test. They just are who they are. So that is what matters.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, if you ever doubt that you were wrong about that, just remember that this is actually kind of funny that you said that, because Enoch Powell once had an interaction with Margaret Thatcher where he said almost word for word to her what
there. I remember it. He said something about it transcends space and time. I know the quote.
Because
yeah.
Ideals cannot be fought for or destroyed. They exist outside of time. It's the British people that you fight for. And a similar thing was said by Benjamin Disraeli in the 19th century, where he said that my beliefs are England. That is what I believe. You know, none of these abstract principles. It's not that you don't believe abstract principles. It's that they are secondary or derivative of something that's more fundamental. There was another point I was going to make. I forget what it is now. But yeah, it's the same idea.
Yeah. Your identity isn't a proposition. It's not an abstraction. It's not something that can be true or false or can be argued into or out of. Your identity at the end of the day, and we say this a lot, is you are your father's son and your son's father. And that's where it ends. And that which is good for that is good. And that which is bad for that is bad. Right? I agree with you. Look, if you told me that for me and mine, the best option was communism, I'd become a communist. I don't care. Those things are completely fluid to me. They'd mean nothing. That which is good for me and mine is good, period. Right? Now, obviously, communism isn't good, but if it was, I'd be it. I'd bring up the hammer and sickle right now. I don't care about those things. Those are just completely ephemeral, illusionary abstractions, right? So it's just the way that it is. Because at the end of the day, what I'm about and what I think guys that have a proper, you know, folkish worldview should have is love. You know what I mean? I love my people. I love the things that I'm about. And there's a lot of guys out there that forget how to love and what love is. And then those guys, I would say, turn it all off. Turn it all off. Have a beer. Eat a slice of pizza. Put on your favorite, your Black Sabbath album. You know, well, I'm just saying because those are my favorite things. But do it and just remember what it means to love something. Because the hardest fight, the people that fight the hardest and stand up and get the most passionate, are the people that are defending things that they love.
Something tangible. As opposed to something abstract. I agree with you. I think that's true. All right. Well, we'll get to the super chats. Darby says 07 to the dads. I don't know what that means, but is that a reference to?
It's an emoji. It's the salute emoji.
Oh, of course. Right. Okay. All right. Thank you for that. Gallic Glory. How did the guest's perspective on life change when they became a father? Culture Dad's insights are excellent and well worth $7 measly a month. Support our folks, people. And the links will be in the description for that. So how did your... Okay, this is a big question.
Big question.
Okay. Dave, you go first. How did your perspective on life change when you became a father?
So I remember the time that my whole worldview changed. So when you, as a man, as you go through these kinds of rites of passage, you're going to change a few times, right? You change when you go through puberty, you change when you get this and do that, blah, blah. And one of the biggest ones is when you become a father. I remember the exact point that, you know, talking about love, that I learned what love is. Really, right? I said, you know, as a young man, I said, oh, I would die for this. I would fight for that. I love this. I love that. I hate that. I hate this. I didn't really understand what those words meant until I held my son, my first son. When my first son was placed in my hands and I saw, you know, that Eric Clapton song, My Father's Eyes. When I saw my father's eyes, the first thought that went through my head, and this is a little bit grim, it's a little bit whatever, but I'm just being honest here. I realized that if I had to, I would kill everybody in this room to protect this baby. I don't care if they're innocent, not innocent. If you said to protect this baby, I got to kill these people, I would choke them nurses out in a second, right? I realized that I really would die for this baby. That's it. And then from that point on, my whole worldview completely changed. That because I'm not me anymore. I'm not just a guy. I now, my life now matters, because if I die, then these people are in trouble. Their existence is upon my existence. And that from that point on, I must live for them. And when you have that pressure on you, when you realize that, you know, when you really, really understand what love is when you have a child, and the same thing with a woman. You don't really, really love a woman until she gives you a child. Until you're in that room, you hear her scream, you feel her pain, she squeezes your hands, and she cries and goes through all of that crap for hours and pushes that baby out. Then you realize that you love this woman, that you are now together forever, right? And going into that, if this woman betrays you, it breaks your heart in a way that you don't even understand, right? Thankfully, you know, my wife is a wonderful woman. She's very loyal. She's never done that. But I know men who have had their hearts broken like that. And that is a heartbreak that is unlike any other. So it changed me completely. Completely.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say something very, very similar. When my first daughter was born, I looked at her and held her, and I promised her that I would do everything and anything within my power to protect her, to make sure that she grew up in a world, in a place, in a home that was happy and healthy, and that would, above either of those things, encourage her flourishing. And I think that actually, like, when I started Imperium, when I started this thing, was just after she was born, or right around the time that she was born. So what I'm doing now with my publishing company and all of my dissident activities and everything like that is an extension of that promise to her. Because I have a duty to make the world better. I have a duty, of course, you begin at home, but you also have a duty to your society as well. This is one of the things that we believe in our spheres, is that we're not just individuals. We're part of a sociality. We're part of a connected network. So it's my duty to improve not only her home, but also like her neighborhood, my local community, and the wider world. And I would be remiss. I would be negligent as a father if I didn't at least try in some way to undo the absolute rivers of poison that are flowing through the culture today. And I think that Imperium is one small way of pushing back against that, because at the end of the day, the reason why things are in the shape that they're in is because good men have neglected to stand up against shitty behavior. And there's a lot of shitty behavior out there. I know something a little bit about, you know, classics and languages and philosophy and things like that. So I can push back in that sphere. I have a duty to do that. I have a duty to try to make sure that she and, you know, the rest of my family now grows up in a world where she does not have to be ashamed of herself to be who she is, to be a white person, to be from this particular country, to be born into this family. And I think my political activities are fundamentally an extension of my fatherhood. So I don't know what it's like for other guys. Obviously not everyone's a father in this thing, and you know, I'm not throwing any shade on them, but that's what motivates me to do what I do.
And going to the pre-rational and the aesthetics, I want to tell a real quick story. So, and this has to do with being a father and everything. I think when I became a father, it unlocked certain parts of my brain that like attached me to like the ancestral line, right? Those things got more important to me. So when I was very, very little, I had a great grandmother. She was Lil Nona, right? I don't remember what she looked. She died when I was like four. I don't remember what she looked like. I don't remember talking to her. I don't even I don't remember anything about her except two things. When I was on my first birthday, she gave me a gigantic stuffed teddy bear. I called it Mr. Big Bear. And I had Mr. Big Bear for years and years until like I had this scumbag dog that like ripped it all up and everything years later. But when I was like 10 or something, I don't know. But I had Mr. Big Bear like forever and ever. And that's, I remembered that. That was a gift from Nona, Lil Nona. And Nona, another thing that she was known for, she made the best fucking meatballs on the planet, right? And I remember being a little kid going over, and I remember the smell of the meatballs. I remember the sauce. I remember the meatballs have a very, when they're getting fried, they have a very unique smell, right? That smell of the garlic and the meat frying and the sauce. You can smell meat. I can smell meatballs from a mile away, right? Especially her meatballs because there's a little bit of sweetness. She did it the old Calabrian way where there's raisins in it, right? Mm. So she made these meatballs. They had a very specific smell, and I remember that smell. On my son's first birthday, I didn't, you know, Lil Nona is far in the depths of my memory. On my son's first birthday, when my son was born, I like, you know, I got screwed. I lost my job. Like me and my wife, we were in the pits. We were like living in a garage. Like, it was rough stuff we were going through. We were going through the struggles and obstacles that a young growing family sometimes goes through, right? So, my son's first birthday, he's nine now, by the way. I had barely any money. I think I had like $20 to my name or something. Nothing, right? And I go to the toy store, and I wanted to get him something for his first birthday. So I walk into the toy store, and the first thing that I saw was on the end cap of the aisle, there was a sale going on. It was like for $9.99, slashed down from $40 or something, was these gigantic teddy bears. And they had a blue bow, like, and it looked exactly like Mr. Big Bear. It was almost the same bear. And I saw the Mr. Big Bears that they were selling. And automatically, I smelled meatballs. I didn't even think about it. I smelled meatballs, the sauce, the gravy. It was known as meatballs. I haven't thought of Nona. This happened in the back of my head. I saw Mr. Big Bear, and I smelled known as meatballs. And I was like, that's what I'm going to get for my son. It's on sale. I can afford it. And I got a Mr. Big Bear. So that is aesthetics. That is the importance of pre-rash. That it being in the moment and being human and having these experiences are really what is important, right? So that's the importance of pre-rational things and aesthetics and stuff like that.
All right. That's a lovely story. Thank you for that. Okay, there was a... Imminent Rain says, hails so hard. Thank you for that. Okay, Dharma Initiate. What would you say to someone who has been abandoned by their own and because of that, they have no loyalty? There are a lot of young single white males, incels, that feel this way today.
Well, first of all, Imminent Rain, shout out Imminent Rain. That's my buddy Luke. Excellent, excellent one-man band. You guys should go check him out if you like heavy metal, old school trad heavy metal. But to a guy like that, so here's the deal is we today have this problem, right? When my grandparents passed, my family split apart. My community was wrecked by the opioid crisis. We, you know, had some trouble, right? I'm not in contact with a lot of my blood family, and that sucks. You know, and I know a lot of guys out there, especially these guys from these younger generations, are raised by single moms and don't know their dads, and they don't have these traditions. Sucks. You know what I mean? If you're one of these guys that grew up like this, that has these troubles, right? Mike, what's it called when you're I think it's a Roman word, where if your father breaks the tradition, then you are obligated to reestablish the tradition or something like that.
Yeah, I can't think of the term. The mos maiorum is the term for tradition, and it translates to the custom of the ancestors, but it also translates to the custom of your superiors. There's a kind of like cool little synonymy going on there. So for them, it was actually what was old was authoritative automatically. So I think that's where that comes from.
So what I would say to those guys is you have the opportunity to rebuild that, you know, especially if you're involved with you know, folk faith, the heathen community like I am. It's very, very easy to rebuild that, to find a woman, to find a some kinfolk and rebuild that in a way. You have to realize that what you set up, everything is transgenerational. This is another problem in modernity is we all want everything in our lifetimes. Our ancestors knew that things took many, many generations to build and fix or fall or whatever. The processes of civilization take many, many generations. You have to understand that in some ways your life is a mulligan and you're going to have to just rebuild, and that you're just laying the foundation for your sons and your children to stand a little bit taller. And then eventually generations from now, they will stand very tall, right? We have to understand that that's the way it is. And that's not a bad thing. That's a cool thing. You know, we get to, let's look at it today. We like to piss it. You know, I do it too, right? We like to moan and complain about the things that we face in modernity and our situation. Let's look at the good things, right? My grandmother used to always say, count your blessings. Let's count our blessings for a minute, right? Nobody's shooting at us. Nobody's trying to kill us. We got food. Let's face it, if you grow up in the West, you can find something to eat. You ain't starving. Even if you ain't got no money, you can go get a can of soup. You can find something to eat. You're not starving. And the food is safe. You don't have to worry about diseases and parasites and all that kind of stuff. You got safe food. You got clean water. You got somewhere to sleep that's out of the rain, that's warm and dry. You know, compared to some of the circumstances that our ancestors went through, they would probably love to trade with us, right? We don't have horrible diseases wiping people out and all this kind of stuff. We got it pretty good. Let's face it. We got it pretty good. And all we have to do is, you know, fun stuff, right? So let's count our blessings and look at, it's really not that bad, right? It could be a lot worse. And maybe in the future will be a lot worse. Or it could be a lot better. We don't know. We have to worry about what's in the now, and what's in the now is we have a wonderful, beautiful opportunity to lay that foundation and, you know, be the dads. You're like the first dad that's going to, you know, generations from now, they're going to look back, they're going to see your picture on the mantle and be like, that guy was a fucking boss, and they're going to be proud of you, for real. That's what I look forward to. This is another thing that especially once I'm 36 now, I have my kids now. For the first time in my existence, I'm starting to understand my mortality. I don't move like I used to move. I have certain, you know, my health isn't as good as it used to be. My voice, you know, I don't have the same vocal range when I sing that I used to. You know, I got friends, they're starting to lose their hair. We're now starting to age. I'm starting to feel my mortality a little bit. Right, I can't go out. When I was a young man, I used to go out, get blasted, wasted, and then wake up in the morning and go to work. Nowadays, if I have a few too many beers, I'm out of commission. I can't handle that no more. I feel my mortality, right? I realize that, and also seeing my kids grow up, that really puts a lot of things in perspective as far as what is really important in life. I feel like just yesterday, my first son, I have three children now. Just yesterday, my son was born. Just yesterday, I blinked and he became a kid. I blinked again. Now he's about to become a teenager. He's 9 years old. He's going to be 10 next year. After that, he's soon going to be driving. I'm going to blink again. They're going to be adults. Blink again. They're going to leave my home. And very soon, I'm going to be an old man. And I have to realize that what is important is right here, right now. That is the most important, not these kind of things that are out in the thinky-think, you know, the stratosphere, whatever that is. What's important is here right in front of me and doing a good job building it, because very, very soon I'm not going to be here anymore. And I want my kids to pull my books out of the boxes, to look at my pictures, and be proud and inspired. You guys listening that might be having these struggles and everything, count your blessings and realize you have a wonderful opportunity to have a lot of fun and to do some really meaningful things in your short, fleeting time on this earth.
Yeah. One of the things that Dave just said there that I think is important, and, you know, this is not to sort of wag, you know, do a finger wag against guys or whatever, is that Dave's right. The world that we live in today is not that bad in material terms. The crisis that we face today is not a crisis of the people starving. It's a crisis of meaning. And that crisis of meaning has been sort of foisted upon us by, like, the earlier generations. You know, boomers are kind of like maybe overly blamed for that, but that's, there's something to that. And for us to look at them and say, we're going to go off in a different direction, isn't this just us saying, fuck you, dad? The way that we said at the beginning of this, that like that is a huge part of the problem, which it is. There's a kind of conundrum there. And it's the conundrum is that's the macrocosm, and the microcosm is, you know, maybe your family has kicked you out or doesn't like want to have anything to do with you because you have unorthodox beliefs. You know, the fact is there's a wonderful quote that goes something like, every generation rebels against its fathers, but makes friends with its grandfathers. And I think that's very, very true. And there's actually something even deeper to that, which is that if you want to reconnect with your ancestral tradition, if you want to reconnect with the past, with everything that's great that you've inherited from your culture and your people and your ethnos and everything like that, that we've been off track for not that long of a time if you really want to, you know, look, pull back and look at things from a wider perspective. So if your father... is like, you know, and I'm speaking metaphorically here, if your father has strayed off of the path, maybe look to your grandfather and look at what the generation before last believed. And if that generation was off track, you just keep going back and back and back until you hit an authority that is something that you can look proudly upon and say, I am descended from that guy, and this is... And he is the one that issues the imperatives that color my worldview. This is what I call the ancestral principle, is that every generation was obligated to its own fathers the way that children are obligated to fathers today. So if the past looks like it's not something worth having, just go a little bit further back. And I think, you know, that's basically the way that we can set things to rights.
Yeah, I would say when we say return the power of the father, we probably should say return the power of the fathers.
Yeah,
going all the way back. Dude, you know, just to say it straight, if your dad's a scumbag jerk off, he's just one guy, right? You can't abandon all of the dads going, all your fathers going all the way back, because his dad was probably decent.
That's an intellectual thing, that decision to make. In the moment, a boy is just going to think, well, my dad was a loser. You know, that is... You would have to really talk him into realizing, yeah, okay, your dad was a loser, but there are other men that you could look up to.
Exactly.
It's not going to happen naturally, you know? The natural position is going to be, well, my dad was a loser, so what do I owe the world, kind of thing. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt there. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it's very true, and... If you look at yourself as not an individual and not even a nuclear family, but a continuum reaching all the way back as a link in the chain of ancestors, then I think that the solution to that problem is actually pretty obvious. And it is to just go a step further back to derive your authority from something a little bit older. So,
yeah, if your dad was a loser, then what about his dad, though? What about his dad and the dad before that and his dad before that? You know, those people, they're still around. They're in the other world and they're watching you, right? So why would you, you know, turn against all of them, right? Make them proud.
Yeah. There's a lot that I could say here because I've been doing research that doesn't matter. It's not entirely pertinent. Just about Scottish, like 100 years ago, stuff that doesn't matter here. So All right. Now this is a reference to what you were saying earlier about pizza. And Darby asks, the Imperium Press Bizarchives cookbook, when?
Oh, man. We talked about it. Yeah.
Probably there will be something. It's just the idea is just gestating right now, but like that will probably be a reality sometime in the next year or so.
That's good. We don't have enough cookbooks coming out of the Dissident, right?
Yeah, we need more of that. That's real praxis right there.
Yeah, I agree, actually, unironically.
So I would never have thought of that, but yeah, I can see it would be a good idea. And there were another couple of super chats. Oh, yes. Gallic Glory says, I have an anthology of poetry relating to capturing the essence of the land and what is lost. I wonder if I compiled it, would either of the gentlemen have any use for it? I don't want profit or anything, and they may think it's shit. So, Gallic Glory, would you be interested in seeing his compilation of poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we take submissions. We get them very, very regularly. So we read all of them and give them due consideration. So go onto the website, click on the contact link, and we would love to hear from you because we need more of that. We need more poetry. You know, this is one of the things that Imperium has. This is what we do. We've published two poets now, who are living poets, contemporary poets, who have written things in the last few years. And, of course, we also published the Imperium Anthology of English Verse, which is all of the greatest verse that has been written in the English language going all the way back to Beowulf. So we love poetry. We need more of it. And it's something that's neglected in our sphere. So we would love to hear more.
Yeah, we do. I actually published a book of poetry called The Weird Works of Dave Martell, for folks who want to do it. For poetry and submissions for the Bizarchives, it has to be fiction or fantasy or horror. We do weird shit. We don't. So we love poetry too, but it's got to be about fantasy things or fucking aliens from outer space or whatever.
All right. Now there's a question for Dave, although it might also apply to Mike. Somebody asks, "How did you?" Oh, hold on a second. Could Dave explain how we came to believe in the pagan gods as truly existing? I'm asking out of genuine intrigue, not to start a religious debate. So if that applies to Mike as well, how did we come to believe in the pagan gods as truly existing?
Well, I would ask you, when did they come up with the idea that they don't exist? You know what I mean? The idea that the gods exist has always been there. Why would they make sacrifices? Let's go with, so some of the modern kind of, I don't want to go too far into religion here, but there are modern interpretations, I guess you could call them, where they say that ancient people believed in nature phenomenon. They worshiped the storm, and it was just like for example, I don't know. Thor is just a manifestation of the storm, and it was just an explanation for a natural phenomenon. Why would ancient people sacrifice animals and people and other things to just like a representation or a psychological phenomenon
or
something like that?
Or
a metaphor. Why would you get on your knees and pray to a metaphor? Why would you build effigies and temples to metaphors? The idea that there was ever any doubt that the gods are real was among ancient people is just bizarre. It's completely modern. It's a modern invention. I would just ask the same question back. When did they come up that they're not real?
Yeah, I don't know if the questioner is asking, when did our ancestors come to believe that the pagan gods truly existed? But that's going back into history that I don't believe is documented anymore. And of course, it differs all over Europe. All right. Well, Mike, do you want to pick up on that question?
Sure. Yeah. Again, I don't really want to get into theology too much because It's not really something that we talk about on the podcast all that much. It's more something that I talk about on my Substack. So, you know, I just recently wrote an article called Where Do Pagans Get Their Authority? Where I basically answer this very question. And let me give you the sort of high-level overview of the ancestor, of the answer. The answer is that pagans get their authority, and that includes epistemic authority, so authority of knowledge, by pointing to examples. So when we say that something like, you know, Christianity is true, really where that comes from, and this goes back to the whole idea of irrationalism or pre-rationalism, nobody reads the Bible as a child and says, okay, well, this is self-evidently true. The reason that people believe, whether it's in Hinduism or Islam or any other religion at all, is because you grew up with it, basically. And if you didn't grow up with it, you grew up with the things that it built, right? At the end of the day, the reason why Christians love Christianity is because it built the West, right? This is when all of the other arguments fall away, that is the fundamental argument. And what it comes down to is that authorship is authority. If something built something else, then it is authoritative over that thing. And it's true, Christianity did build the West, and that this is something that is venerable and beautiful, and I would not begrudge that. I would not say to a Christian, look, your religion is stupid because of whatever, because it did build all of the things that we take for granted. That's very true, and that argument completely works against liberals. But again, with what we were saying before about if your father is wrong, look at your grandfather. Let's push that back a step as well. Christianity wasn't there from the very beginning. It was something that we took on. What was there before? Well, it was paganism. And it gave us, paganism gave us all of the assumptions that we have. It gave us every axiom, including those axioms from which the truth of the Christian religion was derived. It built, paganism built society. Not just Western society, society. It built the idea of law, not just our laws, law. It built custom. It built the idea of governance. It built technology. It built all of the arts, all of the ritual, all of the myth, all of philosophy up until the day before yesterday. It built everything. It laid the foundations of the world. Every axiom that we hold, every intuition that we have, everything came out of this ancient substrate that has been around for hundreds of thousands of years. And the only way for us to conclude that the pagan gods are false or not real is on the basis of assumptions that that tradition gave us. So you can't escape that tradition. It is the authority, whether we recognize it or not. So this is basically what I would say in defense of that, is that the only way that you can conclude that the pagan gods are not real is on the basis of assumptions that the pagan gods gave us. So there is a kind of performative contradiction in arguing against it. That's, in a nutshell, the gist of what I wrote in that article.
And it's like, here's the deal. What I would say is that regardless of what you think you believe, the gods are real, and when you die, you will go to the underworld. You will go to the afterlife. And the authority for which I justify this is that the overwhelming majority of all of our fathers believed this for most of history. Period.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the iceberg underneath the water. Only the tip of the iceberg that's poking out underneath or above has rejected all of these things. And that everything that is great and high and deep and noble about the West sits atop a foundation that is immensely, immensely ancient. And so, you know, my own personal view is that it's a little bit disrespectful and a little bit contradictory to look at that and say, all of that needs to be discarded.
All right. It's a huge topic, and I feel
I know. I didn't really want to get into it, but that is just the tip of the iceberg.
Of course, and I want to acknowledge the thing that you're acknowledging as well, that there is so much to be said here, but there just isn't time because, after all, I was supposed to start with gifts ungiven 15 minutes ago, but we were running late because of the previous stream, so it's not your fault at all. All right. I want to just end by saying, every time I have Dave on, he says at least one thing that is hilarious. And last year he said, he quoted Lovecraft and said I asked him, he said, an undertaking of blasphemous proportions.
Very Lovecraftian, yes.
And this year he said, they don't got the stuff. We got the stuff.
That's the yin and yang of Dave Martell right there.
So thank you for those quotable lines, Dave. And thank you, Mike, as well. This has been a great stream. I think loads of people have enjoyed it. Lots of positive comments there. So, it's been great. So thank you very much. I'll be back in about 5-10 minutes with Gifts Ungiven. In the meantime, Culture Dads, Dave Martell and Mike from Imperium Press, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.